UWA-517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There's 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There's 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merge 1095. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Did we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there. Same airplanes.
And it is such. Bob, I swear to God, four calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty. Four calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the show, wherever in the world you are joining us from. I hope you're all having a good week. Tonight's guest is John Peretti from Texas, sharing his continuous contact, starting when he was a child, when he witnessed an object above the family's property and suffered missing time and the physical effects, like nosebleeds that lasted a considerable amount of time afterwards. And you may just be familiar with John, as he was the founder of Extreme Fighting, a UFC matchmaker, actor, stuntman, producer, and author of The Origin of the Species and the Mixed Martial Arts. John up next. If you enjoy listening to the podcast and would like to help support my work, there is a couple of ways to do this. Either you can join Patreon and become a patron of the show for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate via PayPal. And if you like, you can set up monthly reoccurring payments. All links to support the podcast are below in the show notes and on the website. Any help is extremely appreciated, and it helps the show to continue running. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you.
It is wonderful to have you with us today, and you're calling from Texas.
I'm calling from Houston, Texas, correct.
Now, John, you have had 65 years of contact. Would you be so kind as to start at the very beginning, please, sir?
I will. I was born in August 10th, 1956, 5'6". I was a very sickly child. I had fevers. I had bloody noses, which I'll speak about. I had real problems with sickness from very early on. I will also tell you that I have had a reoccurring nightmare all through into my 30s and 40s, which started. I can't tell you that I can remember at being two, but I will say that I believe that it started around two. The reoccurring nightmare is very dark, and it has sound. It's the nightmare, I would say, is in color, although colorless. It seems to be very graphite-like. And in fact, it kind of feels graphite-like. And I'm a little naked boy, and I'm in this very dark kind of, feels almost like a basement with rounded corners. There's a lot of heavy machinery, gears of type, moving very slowly, kind of like being in a clock, a giant clock. And it's dangerous. It feels incredibly dangerous. And I feel like I'm smeared with some kind of like slippery graphite-like coating. I am also laid out on a really thick, cold slab. And there is an accompanying noise, sounds, which I could hear very clearly and repetitively throughout the years. And it's kind of like an MRI kind of resonance, like a bell's banging and kind of like a electrostatic sound of some kind of charge to it. And I think the whole thing is charged, like, you know, like hair standing up on your neck kind of charged. There's an absolute electrostatic charge to the whole scenario. And it's a horrifying dream to be in because I can't hear myself scream. And I can't move like I would like to. So this went on for a long, long, long time. I can tell you that the timeline went on for 30 years. Some spouses have woken me up out of this part of this dream where I'm actually trying to scream, but I can't even scream in my sleep. There is also this, and this goes on into my late 20s, but I lived in a loft in New York City, and the ceilings were 12 and a half feet high. And it was a big white loft. This is how I know the scale of what I'm looking at. I had many, many instances of not quite being asleep and did not go back to sleep after this occurred. So this wasn't any kind of a sleep anomaly, but I had visitations of this incredibly large, probably 10 feet tall mantis, absolute glossy-eyed, not so green, kind of brown, sienna-ish mantis, up on two legs. I never saw a tail. It looked more like Vitruvian, more, you know, having two arms and two legs. However, its head was absolutely mantis in appearance. And I know for a fact that I was not asleep, nor did I go back to sleep. And this thing scared the dickens out of me for years and years. And it ended probably at like 25 or 26 when I moved out of that loft. But I immediately recalled seeing that, whatever it is, as a youngster, as a really young child, that same peculiar hybrid kind of thing. I've also had, throughout my life, I've had in many, many places, mostly in Mexico, but where I would, I've raised pit bulls my whole life, and I would think that like dogs had, you know, the way they can like lie down against your bed and they could pull like covers back because they're at the bed and they're, you know, trying to take covers off the bed. One time in particular, I was in bed and the covers got all pulled off of me. So I reached down and I was looking around and I was looking for the dogs, but the dogs were on the ranch and they weren't with me and no one was in the house at the time in Mexico. And I did not go back to sleep, which negates any kind of sleep paralysis idea. Again, I didn't see anything or anybody, but that actual stuff actually moved off of me. Mexico is really interesting because my whole family, my six-year-old twins were all, so we'd go out at sunset onto the back of the house, and the sun would be setting in La Paz, Baja California, Mexico. And we would watch the sunset because when the sun set, you could see through the cloud cover and see really interesting things. I mean, it was pretty amazing. We'd see all kinds of strange anomalies in the sky, the whole family. One time, both twins and I and my wife and my mother-in-law, when the sun was setting, and if I held my arm out at full length, the sun was setting as big as my thumb. Not the whole thumb, but that last digit of my thumb. And with the setting of the sun, there was an orb to the right of the setting sun, which was as large as the setting sun. So basically, it looked exactly like there were two suns. Now, the sun set over a mountain, which sets prior to the mountain, between me and the mountain, which is about 8 miles away, is all the Sea of Cortez. So there's no obstructions. So the sun sets behind the mountain and on the mainland. And as the sun goes down to the west, there is this incredible orb, just like two suns, except as the sun sets, which you know the duration of that, which is quite quick, the orb came towards the house and disappeared. So the orb was much closer, obviously, and smaller than the sun, but enormous. Enormous. It was an enormous orb. One of the most interesting things that happened to me, I was going to read it from my memoirs, but I think I'm going to tell it. So it was like 1966, and we had just moved into a new area. My parents, it was like an upcoming area, and it was on about 350 acres of woods. We had a house on a hill on a circular driveway that was just installed. And my father was there, and he was he wanted his Newsday newspaper. So I'd have to go out the door, run right, go down the driveway, which was quite long, and then get the newspaper from the mailbox and then run back upstairs. And so probably for a 10-year-old, that should take me probably not even a minute. So it was in 1966, and it was in the summer, and we had just moved into this area, and I had just turned 10. My father wanted his Newsday, and he was sitting there drinking a martini, and he wanted his mail. And so I jumped out the front door. There was a screen door and a wood door. I opened the wood door. I jumped out the screen door. The porch, which was covered, was about 10 feet long, about little 3 meters. And then I would step down once and step down twice, and I'd be on the tar, and I would make a right to go down. Well, as I stepped out, or maybe it was there before I stepped out, I don't know. I was covered in four white, like metal halide kind of beams of light. And there was the bottom of a saucer that was as big as the ranch house. And I know where it was in space because I was a hunter even then, and I hunted, you know, small mammals and reptiles. And I was very visual, and I recorded it. But the trees at that time, which got much larger, obviously, as they grew, but were only 18 to 20 feet at the time. So I know where this object was in the sky above me. So I'm on this hill. The trees start probably 8 feet below me, within the circle of the circular driveway. I am on the driveway at the footprint of the house. As I emerge, I look up, and this thing is as large as the house. Now, a red and blue lights that are going around the perimeter of it, and four big 10-foot in diameter spotlights. And I'm in the spotlight and there's no shadow underneath me, just the tar illuminated. I have no idea of the duration of this, except that there's one piece of evidence that suggests it was quite a while, because my father said that we was all worried because you was gone for 2 hours and you didn't get the mail. And they sent me to bed and I wouldn't refuse to go back down to the mailbox. I remember the last thing he said was, "Goddamn kid." There was no kind of spiritual aspect to it. There was quite an electrostatic aspect. And that night, and that I was gone for 2 hours, which I can't corroborate. I would say that night, which I know for a fact also because of my mother, she was the homemaker, the perfect homemaker of the 50s. My nose started bleeding, and my nose would bleed so badly and continue to bleed so badly for the next, say, 7 years. And she just, it annoyed the hell out of her that she couldn't keep the white cotton pillowcases clean, because my nose, both nostrils would bleed so badly at night, and they started that night. So if you understand the timeline and the location, which was Long Island, New York, on the just off the expressway, exit 50, this place was a hotbed in the 60s of UFO occurrences, and all along the nuclear and military bases all along Long Island. And many of the drawings that people have, that I've seen, of that people have done of saucers in that area were very familiar. Now, I never saw a profile and I never saw the top of this slightly oscillating saucer. But judging from the way that the construct was, it's very similar to what other people saw during that time period. And very similar to what the Vril were doing in Antarctica, and the use of saucers for however far they ventured out. I will tell you that my mother and my grandmother were National Socialists. They were Nazis. And the area that I lived had a lot of paper-clippian Germans residing there. And they worked at Grumman and Fairchild Hiller and all these other, you know, quasi-military industries all along that area. And I wouldn't be surprised if the drawings that I've seen and the images that I've seen, the photographs taken, that those ships are, if not identical, very, very, very similar. So I will tell you that area was a hotbed, and a lot of people saw some very similar things. I will say that I was not injured by the experience, not like people in Brazil who are burnt by this experience, by the light. And I don't know, again, the duration of the experience, nor can I recall anything that did occur in that moment, however long it was. At 15, I was in the Poconos with my grandmother, who had cataract surgery, so she could hardly see. And I was up at Hunting House with my parents. I had a 3x9 scope on my Remington Model 700, my deer rifle. We were right in the Poconos across the Delaware River from New Jersey, where the Kittatinny Arsenal was. And this was a really famous place then also. I was 15. So I was out on the back porch And I started to see, like, over the Kittatinny Arsenal, which is about 8 miles away, and it was really clear at night. I started to see, like, I don't know, some kind of, like, fire in the sky. I brought my scope out, and I laid it on the sandbags that were in the backyard. I brought it up to 9, and I was looking at it, and I called everybody out of the house to look at it. And this fire, kind of fiery-looking thing, was parallel to the ground and was moving kind of left, right, and then came directly at the house instantaneously, probably 6 miles. And it absolutely had a fiery tail to it, kind of like, I don't know, like a kind of rocket kind of discharge, but it wasn't going up or down, and it could stand still. And it had this fiery little tail to it, which was strange. Not that the tail emanated from the back of it, just that it was there, which I've heard others talk about. And I had it on a scope, and I even put my grandmother on that scope, and she saw it. And it was dead quiet. There was no noise. And then all these fighters came. All these jet engine fighters were all over this thing, and they were just everywhere, and they roared, and they had, you know, the typical sounds of jet engine aircraft, and they were zipping all over. There must have been like 5 or 6 of them. And this thing went in my scope from maybe 2 miles away to gone. And it didn't go up. It didn't go down. It kind of went back towards the arsenal and disappeared within, I don't know, a microsecond. And these guys flew around for probably another hour, I guess, looking for it, and did not find it. And all kinds of witnesses on that one. I will tell you that I have seen orbs in Japan. I have seen all kinds of strange anomalies in New York, in California. There's been, you know, quite a lot of contact in my life. There was a story that I heard on your program of a woman about an elevator. You recall that? An elevator that shouldn't have been there?
Yeah, that's Monica.
Well, Monica's, when she said that, I recalled at like 15 or 16, going into an abandoned house all along the Delaware River. The houses got abandoned and bought up for pennies. They were going to build this project called the Tox Island Dam, which was a nonsense project by Pennsylvania and New Jersey to make money. And it never got built, but they bought all the property up for nothing and then got to sell all the property at a huge increase in price. So I went into this abandoned house, and in this two-story abandoned house, when I was 15 years old, I'd been in there many times looking for snakes and things and old bottles and things I was collecting. And in this one abandoned house, one day there was an elevator. A lot of people say, oh, I got so scared and I ran away and this and that. But I did not do that. And I stayed there and I played with the elevator, which was not supposed to be there and was never there again. It did not open. It did not illuminate. It did not. But I had forgotten completely about that until Monica mentioned that on your show. I will also tell you that I have had one genuine out-of-body experience, which was viewed by my cousin. I was in a 1967 Mercury. I can't remember the name of the car right now, but it was kind of like a Mustang. Oh, it was a Cougar. And I was driving this Cougar, and my cousin was in the passenger seat, and I was driving really slow. I got yanked up right out of the top, the white top of the blue Cougar, right out of my seat, and was watching myself as if there was no roof on the car. And I guess I let go of the wheel And at like 10 miles an hour, I started driving into parked cars, and my cousin grabbed the wheel. And when he grabbed the wheel, I guess there was like a crashing sound, but it was in my head, and I came crashing back into my body. It was an absolutely amazing experience that I tried to get to and go back to many, many times to no avail. But it was one breathtaking experience. After so many odd, the mantis and other reptilian things that occurred, I did 1 year of hypnosis with a Dr. Maran in New York. He was a legitimate guy. It was an amazing experience. And I got to see all kinds of stuff. And the only thing that I can compare it to, I forgot his name right now, but he's got these incredible photographs of UFOs and these experiences. He's got one arm. He lost his arm in a bus accident. He had put his arm out the window in India or something, got his arm ripped off. He's probably has the most beautiful photographs of UFOs ever. He's in like Sweden or I can't remember where.
Oh, you mean Billy Meyer?
Yeah, Meyer. So he, by the way, the saucer that I saw resembles Billy Meyer's Germanic saucers, I mean, to a T. Although I never saw it in profile or in or from the top, but those Germanic saucers, you know, were prevalent in New York, very similar to what was over the White House in 1960. But what I wanted to say about Meyer talks about this. And this did not happen in dream sequence. This happened in hypnosis. But Meyer talks about going back in time, being taken back in time and seeing dinosaurs. And in hypnosis, I had probably 20 sessions that were just dinosaurial. And they actually had in the hypnosis, they actually had a humidity and what I thought to be like a sulfuric smell while viewing these images of dinosaurs. And I was a painter at School of Visual Arts. I taught there for 10 years in college. For about a year during and through this hypnosis, I did all these dinosaurial expressionistic renditions of these dream sequences, which I'm not sure they were dream because I never dreamt them. But I saw them in vivid, vivid color during hypnosis. There's right now I live in the city and haven't been able to really go out. But Dr. What's his name? Greer. He's like from Atlanta, Georgia.
Stephen Greer.
Yeah. So he gave I listened to him or I read one book. I'm a voracious reader. I read one book and he talked about that he had a sound that was given to him of crop circles being made and that he used a military laser and put it out. And I started doing that in Mexico, putting out a military laser and trying to do some meditation to try to see things at night. And I thought that was quite successful. I didn't have a soundtrack, but I thought that was quite successful. It saw like triangular things and saw all kinds of things that moved in very erratic fashion while doing that. But I will say that, you know, he's onto something and find it very, very interesting. And there's just been, you know, a tremendous amount of things that have happened and some really odd occurrences in my life. Even in Houston, when I was in the academy, my girl, she saw an accident and of a motorcycle and an 18-wheeler right at Hammerley Boulevard and Britmore in Houston. I thought I had seen someone walking with a helmet. And I talked to a guy at the academy, a state police, and he said that at night he had seen, after a fatal accident, he had seen, absolutely seen, during his 20 years on night shift, dead people after accidents that they just didn't know where to go. And I firmly believe that if you're out there at night, I work evening shift, so I get off at midnight, you will see things if you have eyes. And as you say, you know, and if you're looking at the sky or, you know, or being attentive, you will see things that other people just walk past and don't notice.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
I think that I've seen strange looking people that were tall and thin and had bright blue eyes that just didn't look quite right, especially in Japan when you don't see anybody who's very tall or nobody besides myself who has blue eyes. If you're being attentive, you do see things that other people do not see. This life has been quite extraordinary, and I've been really fortunate to have seen and participated in things that I don't understand. Again, I'm an avid reader. I really there's some really good books out there. There's a pretty amazing book out there on Antarctica. I can't remember his name who wrote it, but he's written a bunch of books which were, I thought, less effective, but it was pretty great book he wrote on Antarctica and what's been going on down there. I will tell you one more thing that occurred in 77. I was working in Peru for a photographer. We were working on Women's Day magazine, and I was in Peru in Lima, and there was a coup during that time. It was called the Black Dog Coup, when they hung black dogs on lampposts. And I was looking in rooms in this old hotel, which had like 20-foot tall doors. And I had opened these wooden doors. And in the room was a large table that was about 40 feet long. But anyway, the room had been set. And there was one individual who stopped me at the door. There were people seated all down the room, and no one was eating, and everyone was dressed in, except for three women who were dressed in, like, I don't know, giant lapel suits from like the post-40s, were wearing military uniforms, and they were all probably, you know, second and third generation Nazis. They all had brown uniforms and black uniforms and swastikas and skull buttons, and they were in the beginning ready to have quite a party there. White uniforms, and I don't remember any camouflage uniforms, but, you know, everybody was dressed to the hilt, and they were having a meeting in Peru, and I walked in on it and was escorted out, very happy for my blue eyes in the room. And it was quite frightening what was still going on in South America. But that was 1977. Anyway, the interesting part about that is that whole Nazi thing, you know, still followed me from my parents and from the people in the neighborhood, and paperclip, how people were brought over and that they dominated, you know, everything, as Eisenhower warned us. I just think it is quite remarkable that, you know, no one talks about it still. And we don't really have a handle on the amazing things that were done, you know, prior to World War II, no less after. You know, no one gives credence to to the you know, amazing machinery that came out of Germany and went to Antarctica in, you know, in the 30s. That's about it, Nick.
When you used to have nosebleeds, did you ever have it checked out?
Yes. Yeah, I did. They wanted to do, well, you know, I broke my nose 5 times way thereafter, but they said that there was scar tissue up in my nose. They sucked it out with like a what we would call arthroscopic, I guess now, but in those days it was quite primitive. But there was scar tissue in my nose. No, there was no biopsies or anything of it, but I have no idea what was up my nose, so to speak.
You did have it for a very long time, didn't you?
Yes, till I was probably 17. And then it was gone. I had that thing, you know, roto-rooted out. It's an American expression for a company that does toilets. It got cleaned out, and then, you know, deviated my septum, broke my nose 5 times, but never had any kind of a situation like that thereafter. But that's when it started, absolutely, because my mother talked about it for a long, long time. And there were no conversations about things in the sky or in my household or, you know, any kind of reference to anything supernatural. Wasn't like, you know, my father was an atheist. It wasn't like there was any kind of, you know, conversation or anything about stuff like that in those days, although people saw stuff all the time, especially where I lived.
Now, to our listeners, when John refers to his memoirs, the reason is because he's also an author, and he wrote a book called The Origin of the Species and the Mixed Martial Arts. And this is actually, you actually have your experiences within this book as well.
Oh, absolutely. There's like probably 3 or 4 within the book.
I mean, you pretty much coined the term mixed martial artist as well.
I did.
You were the first one.
Yeah, and created the rounds and the gloves with Dr. Aswanek and the weight classes and the extreme fighting ring. Then the UFC put extreme fighting politically out of business, and they hired me the next day, Bob Meyerowitz, to be the fighter liaison and the color commentator and the matchmaker for that event. And eventually we got weight classes and got all the rules got stated and so on and so forth. And the rest is airbrushed history.
I mean, they were the glory days.
Yeah, I'm a has-been, definitely.
I certainly remember watching the very, very early days. I mean, I do kind of still watch it now and again now, but to me, it's not like it was.
No, and I think I came in at UFC 16. You know, extreme fighting was just light years ahead of because it was my show, it was light years ahead, Donald Zuckerman, of anything out there. We just couldn't maintain because they took us off of pay-per-view and got a lot of bad press. But, you know, what you got to understand is that, you know, I've been doing, you know, this and trying to be the best, you know, fighter in the world. You know, that was my goal from, you know, 17 on, you know, so it was, you know, I was mixing martial arts even back then, but it was a real pleasure, you know, working with Donald Zuckerman and we became real fast friends. We worked through some really tough times. There's a great documentary called Battlecade Extreme Fighting. It's a German documentary of Extreme Fighting 2, where everybody got arrested and we went to prison up in Quebec. But, you know, again, you know, when others buy an organization, I always said that the first 16 fights I knew for a fact were purposeful mismatches. You know, I've stated it over and over and over again. People just don't want to hear it. But, you know, me watching a show and someone else watching a show, some neophyte, is very different because I had an educated eye. Because I knew what I wanted to do.
And for the mixed martial arts, you would literally dive headfirst into the learning, the training of each different aspect.
Well, I joined 4 schools at once. They were all basically the same. It was Muay Thai, Tang Soo, Taekwondo, and Hapkido. They were all basically the same. And I think I got my first black belt in 1 year and 5 months. I was just dove headfirst in. And then I moved to Chinatown in New York City and started studying Wing Chun, Kung Fu, and my hands started coming up pretty good. So I had a world-class right leg, probably lost 60% of my amateur fights, but I had a world-class right leg. In fact, Black Belt Magazine still says I have the most vertical sidekick. So and then I dropped it all to kickbox, and then I left and I went to train with Gene LaBelle in California. It was the best thing I ever did. Started grappling with Gene LaBelle and was one of his four original black belts. So I'm pretty proud of that. Put my hands and feet in my back pocket for 10 years and then brought them out again. Started extreme fighting through Donald Zuckerman. We, we did amazing things with what we could do. So it was my dream. And if you want to look at like UFC's top 50 fights after all this time, they were still mine a couple of years ago. So with no budget.
I know if you Google John Borelli, you've done loads of stuff. But as well as this, you also was a stuntman,
yes.
An actor, a producer. What haven't you done, John?
I am now the oldest rookie in the history of the United States on patrol. So I went into the academy at 63. I'm 65 as of last week, and I'm on patrol in Fort Bend County as a sheriff's deputy. So I'm living a new dream and trying to endeavor to persevere, so to speak.
You were the sheriff deputies that you certainly wouldn't want to mess with.
Well, it's all relative, you know. You're only as good as your last fight. You know what I mean?
You're the last person you want to see down a dark alley.
I don't know. My night vision's not what it used to be. I now use these things called flashlights.
That is really amazing, John. How do you think your experiences actually affected your career?
I think that, I'm still this astute visual learner. I struggle, with computer skills. I have to deal with like 20, 3-year-olds who, can do things in a minute and a half that take me an hour. It's the new generation has skills that they can just do things that I can't do. They can multitask on a level that I could never even think of multitasking. I have to really focus on what I'm doing. I can't type while I drive at 100. I just can't do what young people can do. Although I do bring other things to the job that, some say are uncoachable. So, I'm not what I was, but I'm still trying, Hey, I don't know if you have another minute, but I found the August of 1966 rendition. If you want to hear it, I'll just read it to you.
Yeah, you go right ahead. Yeah.
In August of 1966, my family had just moved to a new upscale house in Melville, New York, off the expressway at exit 50, a largely undeveloped 300-acre area with 10 model homes on a hill that was formidable by Long Island standards. It was a favorite winter sledding area. One neighbor was a World War II era German import who rebuilt cuckoo clocks. His whole garage went Hitchcock every hour on the hour in a bird song of synchronicity. Germans were relocated by paperclip to the U.S. government through the eastern United States. The weather on the East Coast reminded them of the fatherland. That's a quote, actually. Down the street, a weathered Italian witch lived on a corner near a bus stop. Her home perched high atop a circular driveway with a lengthy black mane and a curvilinear body. She looked like the later Morticia Adams. She was sexy and all the boys thought so. The bus stop was catty-cornered in the morning due to pause to wait for all to load while stumbling on steps to catch a glimmer of her sole silhouette in the upper middle wooden windows, femininely framed. One humid, clear night, I went out the front door to get my father, who was seated with his Smirnoff martini in thick hand, longing for his much desired newsday and mail. I exited the screen door for the right side of the new 40-foot circular driveway to the new iron mailbox. However, just over the southern pine trees, which were only 20 feet tall, appeared a silver, metallic-looking saucer. It hovered in place with bluish and reddish lights spinning around the outer rim and four bigger, 10 feet in diameter, bluish-white floodlights configured in an approximately 40-foot square, instantly casting an illumination on only me and the underfoot tar. It was much bigger than our 3-bedroom single-story ranch house. I cannot recall ever seeing the top or a profile. It appeared from nowhere or was there when I egressed out the door in a sudden hurry. I suddenly was stopped in my young, trembling tracks. I was already quite a hunter of small game and reptiles. I noticed things. It seemed not quite still, but didn't go anywhere, oscillating just so slightly. I remember it vividly and in color, not in dream or delusion. No shadow was cast below me. There were four cool spotlights on me, and I still do not relish the spotlight. The duration of this immersion will be ever unknown to me, although the clock must have been ticking off pieces of tumbling time. It was a charge to the air and in my hair, with a metallic ozone odor like Mr. Clean or ammonia. That evening was hot. My face was hotter. I must add that later my father was screaming at me, although he always was, wanting me to know where I was and where I had gone for the last 2 hours and why I'd forgotten the mail. We was all worried. I took the verbal battering and remained standing and shaken. I said nothing to him, but would not return to the mailbox, even under the threat of violence, and went sent directly to my room. Goddamn kid. That's all I know about it. I recall nothing else. There was never any talk of oddities in the sky in my home, more about the meshing of mortar for mostly money walls. He was a bricklayer. I will note for the record, as I recall, my chronic nosebleeds began on a duck-filled pillow of the bleached 1960s white on that, for me, shortened night. My mother found them particularly disturbing since blood was very difficult or impossible to totally remove from the continuously changing cotton cases. This was an embarrassment for her, the tidy homemaker of the 60s. At age 10, I knew nothing of what so many others had witnessed worldwide from the apparent above. In retrospect, it seemed like Eastern Long Island in the 60s was a hotbed of UFO sightings all up and down the South Shore and along the length of the expressway and near and over local military nuclear facilities. Many drawings and descriptions of these encounters are very similar to what I acutely remembered seeing on that night. I do not recall contact. I would be measured many times in the future for appendage collisions by other human beings looming over me, some very successfully. And I must say there was nothing archetypal in my encounter, more technological. My hairs did stand up, some electrostatic charges notwithstanding. No visions of angels, no subsequent prayer sessions. My experience was unlike documented by Dr. Carvalho, Brazil, who treated many in 1977 with blackened wounds of red and purple that would appear immediately from the light from the flying saucer. Hair would fall out the next day. Two women died from their odd radioactive wounds. The Air Force took many pictures and abruptly left. My hair did fall out, although 25 years later. Maybe Daniel Galul was right, incorrect, in suggesting that we might live in a simulation set up by some vastly superior civilization, or maybe he was simply wrong. I would like to know. So would a lot of people.
Wonderful. What I'll do is I'll put the link to The Origin of the Species and the Mixed Martial Artist, because I know there's a lot of people interested in these UFO encounters and as well as martial arts and stuff. So certainly check it out. John, I really appreciate you coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on tonight.
Yeah, it's great. Great talking to you. Just keep up the good work.
Thanks, John. The idea is, probably said it about 100 times on the show, that people will hear your account and either be able to relate to it, or have similar experiences. Very much like when you mentioned about Monica earlier, having the elevator experience.
And you had that really articulate guy from Oregon, and he was a little younger than me. But I really thought, a lot of things that he said were very, very similar to so many things that I witnessed.
I'd certainly put you in the same box as I think you're talking about Rob.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's his name. Yeah, he was very articulate. And I think I listened to that episode like 3 times.
He's a really nice guy.
OK, thank you so much again for your time.
You're more than welcome, John. You take care of yourself, and I'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right.
Okay, bye, John.
Bye.
That is all for today. Keep updated and connected with the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you have an encounter that you'd like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com or reach out to me via the contact page on my website at ufochroniclespodcast.com. A big thank you to John for sharing tonight, and thank you all for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.